I'm Seattle Times political reporter Jim Bruner.
And I'm Seattle Times City Hall reporter Dan Beekman.
Let's talk politics.
Let me tell you a little bit about myself first, because a lot of people out here don't understand that they are actually one, maybe two paychecks away from being homeless. I was married for 15 years to a truck driver who made over $110,000 a year. I had everything. I had the house, I had the three cars, the cat, the kid. And now I've been out here for 5 years homeless because I was a mom who wasn't prepared to lose anything. And I lost everything.
Welcome to episode 121 of The Overcast, the Seattle Times News and Politics podcast. This week, we're going a little meta. We're going to talk about another podcast that I think is worth your time. It's called Outsiders, a joint project between KNKX and the Seattle Times Project Homeless Team. I'm joined to talk about the reporting in this by Will James of KNKX and Scott Greenstone, reporter for the Seattle Times Project Homeless. Thanks, Will, for being here and talking about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Scott, thank you too.
Thank you.
So you collaborated for a year of reporting in Olympia on homelessness in Olympia, where tent encampments and outside camping sort of sprouted up very rapidly near the state capitol. How did you conceive of this project, Will? I think that you kind of got the ball rolling on it. What was your purpose when you conceived of this?
Yeah. At the time, I was covering homelessness a lot, and Olympia had sort of grabbed my attention because it was a small city. It kind of defied this view of homelessness as something that happens in big, you know, metropolises like Seattle. And watching it unfold in this kind of pretty small town was really kind of jarring and bizarre. And it also felt like watching this issue rise in real time. I kind of felt like Olympia was in a place that Seattle was in, maybe during like the Murray administration, like maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, and that Tacoma maybe was in 2 or 3 years ago, where homelessness kind of reaches this point that people can't ignore it anymore, and suddenly it is the dominant public policy issue of the city. I felt like I was watching that happen in real time in Olympia. And I was like, this is a story. This is an opportunity to use a city as a microcosm to understand this issue in a way that we hadn't before. And part of it was also like, as a reporter, I was still trying to wrap my head around this issue. I was at this point where I felt like the more I reported on homelessness, kind of the less I understood it. Like, I would kind of feel like I was wrapping my mind around what was going on. And then I would do a day in the field talking to people in encampments, and I would come back even more confused. And I said, you know, this is hard to capture in day-to-day news stories. I want to try to do something longer and something, try a format that we might actually be able to capture the complexity of this issue in.
And then, Scott, just really quickly for people who might not be familiar, Seattle Times Project Homeless started, I don't know how many years ago, and it's a kind of a grant-funded solutions journalism project, right? And so you hooked up with Will to do this, and have you been reporting on it for approximately the same amount of time?
Yeah, so no, not quite as long as Will. It started in October 2017, this project. Project Homeless is funded by the Starbucks Foundation, the Paul G. Allen Foundation, a lot of other, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a lot of other philanthropic trusts. And our goal has been to do what we're doing in this podcast, to explain and explore why homelessness is so bad in a city and a region that's doing so well economically. And since I started there, I've really wanted to do that. I've wanted to do that through a podcast. I think a podcast affords us the ability to talk about things in a way that we can't necessarily in newsprint. And so I started talking with Will when he was probably a few months. The idea was coalescing in his head, but he was a few months at least into the reporting process. And then we started going down with him, and he started showing us what he was talking about. And what we saw, I just want to say really quick, was also, beyond the fact that it's a microcosm, is also incredibly dramatic. Olympia, went, as Will probably mention, went from 30 tents to 300 in a couple of months in 2018. And so it was actually, in a lot of ways, more dramatic, but on a smaller scale than Seattle.
Yeah, let's kind of dive into that first episode again, the Outsiders podcast. One episode is out, another one is dropping this week. And you kind of lead off looking at what I think the city of Olympia calls its mitigation site. Can you explain what that is and how, maybe talk a little bit about the homelessness coordinator there and what he has tried to do? And we'll dive more into whether it's been successful or not too.
Yeah, so about a little over a year ago at this point, Olympia was grappling with, as Scott said, this sudden explosion in unsheltered homelessness downtown. At the time, the city had just hired someone to manage the response to homelessness. He had no idea this would happen, of course, in advance, but he was pretty new to the job. He had worked on homelessness in Tacoma previously, but he had just moved, just started working in Olympia. And his solution was to say, let's take one of these encampments, which has taken over a city parking lot downtown. Let's temporarily ask people to leave. And then let's set up a legal camping site on this downtown parking lot, less than a mile from the Capitol, blocks away from the kind of scenic, historic downtown in Olympia, actually like a block away from it. And maybe this can be an option for this subpopulation of the homeless population that we haven't been able to reach in any way before. You know, homelessness obviously isn't one thing. There are different manifestations of it. And the one that was rapidly rising in Olympia was kind of the most visible and the most complex one. It was people who are often chronically homeless. They've been homeless for years. Many of them, although certainly not all, but many of them have complex health problems like mental illness or substance use disorders, or often both. Psychological trauma going back to childhood that has affected the trajectory of their entire lives. And often that subpopulation is not connected to a system in any way. They're not on anyone's like radar. They're not a name on a list in any city program or anything. So he said, maybe this can be an entry point for this subpopulation that really no city has been that successful in reaching so far.
And I think we can all visualize what it looked like. But when that unsanctioned, I guess, tent city or tent encampment was there, what did that look like? And then what did the city try to do, to clear away that? And what did they replace it with?
The one on the parking lot looks very similar to the encampments you see on the sides of the highways in Seattle, except this was, on a parking lot, but it was packed with tents. It was like tents like crammed right up against each other, and people's belongings kind of spilling into the small spaces between the tents. It was a really jarring sight. The mitigation site at first was the mitigation site that replaced that unsanctioned encampment at first looked pretty orderly. It was like these uniform like gray and green tents. They looked brand new. They were brand new. And there was a chain link fence around the site, kind of providing some sense of security, but also kind of shielding the mitigation site from view. The tents were lined up in neat rows. Now, over the course of a year, that situation has changed. And I think Scott was there fairly recently at the mitigation site and saw what it looked like after a year of being lived in.
Right? Yeah, a year and some change. And it, I think, has gotten a little bit closer to what it may have looked like before the mitigation site popped up. A lot of folks have been allowed to, some of them have brought in their own tents. So a lot of those brand new green tents have disappeared. People have started building structures on top of their tents or around their tents. The only difference, I think, or the only big difference maybe, is that now there's a fence around, there's a guardhouse, there's a tiny house where case managers meet with their clients. And there is a very strict rule of you keep all your belongings in this 10 by 10 by 10 space that you have. And that you can't let them fall outside of that.
And we're kind of discussing it as a place. Let's talk about some of the people that you met and have kind of profiled. Who has stood out and what have you learned about people's situations that are living there?
Yeah, this was actually really key to the whole project, because a reality of reporting on homelessness is that your subjects are sometimes very complicated. In radio, they're very often not what we call good talkers. I don't know if you've heard that term, but in like radio reporting, you're always looking for people who are quote unquote good talkers, which means they tell their story in a succinct and compelling way. But you know what? What you realize quickly in radio is that that often limits your subjects to a certain class and education level and personal history. And I was not hearing the voices of the people I was meeting in these encampments reflected like in audio journalism very much, because their stories are more complicated. What you saw a lot of was like kind of, you see a lot of stories of homelessness that focus on sometimes the most straightforwardly sympathetic stories to middle class ears, kind of. So you hear a lot of people who were, a mom or a dad who had a job and got laid off and became homeless. The kind of the we're all one paycheck away from homelessness story, which is true. But it also doesn't really capture the reality of people's lives in these encampments.
And then maybe there's also the opposite view that you see in some media, for example, where everybody is a meth user.
Exactly.
who is a menace. And I think one woman you talked to that stands out to me was, her name goes by Tall Sarah.
Yeah.
And she talked about the interplay between, for example, drug use and abuse and homelessness. What did she say?
Yeah, and Tall Sarah is a perfect example of like what we were trying to do, which is capture the reality of people who are unsheltered and chronically homeless, but capture their humanity at the same time. Like, I think that's possible. You can show someone's complexity and also not dehumanize them. And Sarah's a great example of that, because Sarah walked right up to me during one of my field reporting trips early on in this process and said, I want to explain this to you because people don't get it. She said, there's this view that people are kind of living these stable lives. They start using drugs and then they become homeless. And what she said to me was, like, that is, sometimes true, but often it's that homelessness drives drug use. It's one of the only ways that people can regulate their stress and their emotions when they're in this really stressful environment and suffering from chronic, constant stress. It's obviously not a good way. It's not a healthy way to deal with that, but it's the only way some people have figured out to deal with that chronic stress. Actually, Scott has spent a lot of time with Tall Sarah over the course of this series and follows up with her story later on, and gets really into these conversations about the intersection of drug use and homelessness.
Yeah, Sarah's a great example too, because she actually also was a mom, had the house, had multiple cars, was married to a guy who had a job, and she says he made over $100,000 a year. And I just want to add that what she said to Will is at least partially backed up by data. There's not great studies on it. There's not great data around homelessness in general, but one study out of LA that actually reviewed people's like records from the LA Homeless Services Authority found that people who were newly homeless were way less likely to be using drugs than people who are chronically homeless, which could be one of two things. The people who keep using drugs stay homeless longer, or being homeless for a long time more often pushes you into drugs.
There's kind of the way you set up this podcast, I feel, Will, the first episode anyway, I feel like there's a questioning spirit and there's also a hopeful optimism that you want to bring to it. And, we'll see as you go along, it's still ongoing how it goes, but for example, you have this moment where the Olympia homelessness coordinator, Colin DeForest, is talking with the group of people in this, I think at the time, unsanctioned encampment, saying, hey, I want to explain to you what we're going to do and try to bring them on board. And they had a reaction that you said was very interesting and compelling that you hadn't seen before. Can you describe that scene?
Yeah, the reason that made it into the podcast was because in the moment, I was kind of shocked and surprised by that. So like you said, Colin DeForest is explaining, we're going to set up a sanctioned camping place in the heart of downtown Olympia, and we're going to invite you all to live there, and we hope you do. And I was kind of, I wasn't quite rolling my eyes in the moment, but I was saying, you know, is anyone actually going to buy into this, right? I mean, there's a history of distrust between local governments and their homeless populations due to policing and kind of kicking people out of alleys and sidewalks. And all of a sudden, after he announces this, the crowd that is gathered around him, one guy kind of makes a wisecrack about how the plan is intense, and it's kind of a lame pun, right? And people start laughing, and then they just start cheering and applauding this plan. And it was so bizarre because there is this kind of baseline of distrust usually between local governments and the homeless population. So yes, it does start on that optimistic note, because I think, you know, a story has to have at least some tension to it, right? There has to be some possibility that things work out in a way that you don't expect. And with homelessness, the expectation is that things will go badly.
And of course, it has been complicated and difficult. And both in the podcast and Scott, you had a story in the Sunday paper that I think addressed this to some extent. There have been objections by the businesses, for example, that are around these encampments. Can you talk a little bit about those? What there was a lawsuit filed, and it complicated the situation, didn't it? What happened there?
Yeah, when they were looking to open it up, when the day that they started moving people in, several of the business owners around, one of whom had just bought a lot directly adjacent to this mitigation site, filed a restraining order with the judge, saying that essentially, you know, you can't do this. You've circumvented your own city policies for opening up this site, and it's just going to worsen the drugs, worsen the crime. Just uphold the law and get them out, you know, of downtown. And you know, that lost in court eventually, although it worked for a little while. Will details really well in the first episode the kind of stop and start of that first day where they opened it up, they got a bunch of people to come in, and then they had to like close the gates. But you know, I talked to Doug Hay, the business owner who lives right next door, who had hoped to open up he works in construction, and he'd hoped to open up a showroom for his products. And you know, he's still you know, upset. He's kind of resigned, I think, a little bit. There hasn't been, I think, a pushback on the level of what maybe we see today in Seattle or something like that, especially not now. But I think that there are certainly business owners who still are really struggling with the mitigation site. And it's not actually just folks in the business community. There are also Olympia, you know, is a place. Evergreen State College is there. There's a lot of leftist and sort of what a lot of people call housing justice advocates, people who are pushing for housing for all, but who are also pushing to make more of these camps legal and let people shelter in place, is what they call it. And a lot of those folks have an issue with the mitigation site as well. I talked to Ty Gundel, who runs Just Housing Olympia, which is an advocacy organization that it calls itself a housing justice organization. And she was saying, you know, we should have more of these that are not quite so large, because the mitigation site being over 100 people, it's hard for the site to self-govern itself. It's hard for the homeless folks to actually work together to democratically run their own camp. And because of that, a lot of people have gotten kicked out or left because they felt that the rules were sort of unevenly enforced on them. And in fact, since the mitigation site opened up, at least as of January, 70 people have either been kicked out or have left on their own, which is more than the number of folks who have left for housing.
That's interesting. And I want to get to that fundamental question I think you were trying to answer. You know, was this effort successful after more than a year? What are the numbers, and what do the people, you know, who were involved say on whether this was a success? I can't actually recall. Maybe you can remind me, was there a target, you know, to move a certain number of people along, or did they just start go into it with no metrics, or has it been successful?
I'll throw this to Scott in a second because he's looked into this quite a bit. But no, starting out, the hope was rather vague, but it was that Olympia could provide a model for larger cities, for other cities in general, that had failed to manage homelessness successfully and that were struggling to manage homelessness, that Olympia would serve as a laboratory to figure out a solution to this seemingly intractable problem of rising unsheltered homelessness. They didn't know at the time what that would look like, but they just kind of bet on their own ability as a forward-thinking city full of government employees, being the state capital, who really believe in the power of people like themselves to figure things out and solve problems, that they could do this. And there weren't metrics tied to it at the time. I'll throw to Scott, who has looked at the numbers on this, you know, a year in.
Yeah, it's kind of it really does depend on how you measure success. Since December 2018, 23 people went from the mitigation site into some sort of housing, and 35 others moved into the tiny house village that opened up on Plum Street. So a little over 50 people, almost 60 people, have moved out of the mitigation site into a spot that's better than the mitigation site. But that's out of an estimated 250 who have lived there. And so, you know, that's not necessarily stunning numbers. But I also think that when I talked to Colin DeForest, the city's homeless response coordinator, he pointed to other things because he said, you know, it's not just about getting people into housing. It's also how do we control our downtown and get the camps under control? And he believes that, you know, that has really been successful. The number of needles picked up in downtown have gone down. The number of feces picked up from downtown has gone down. And I thought that was really interesting because I see in Seattle often we do discuss efforts against homelessness as simply efforts to get folks into housing, which I think probably most of us would agree should be the main goal. But when people are complaining about homelessness, they're usually complaining about needles on the ground and feces in downtown, things like that.
I also want to jump in real quick and say that it's really hard to find an apples to oranges comparison to what Olympia is trying to do, because the city in this case is trying to help a subpopulation of the homeless population that most cities do not really do anything for, are not able to provide anything for. These are the most complex cases of chronic unsheltered homelessness, the people who have been kicked out of shelters, who have been kicked out of housing programs or don't qualify for them for various reasons, the people who, when the navigation team comes into a camp, just sort of decline help and drift off to another camp. Really, there aren't a lot of comparisons to a city trying to address this population in a meaningful way. And any of the numbers should be taken with that context, I think.
And so those most difficult cases, the numbers don't necessarily reflect whether they've reached the people who you describe, who are some of the most difficult cases to move on to permanent housing, for example.
I think what Colin DeForest would say is that and he's the Olympia's homeless response coordinator again. What he would say is that it is a success to even get someone in that situation to move into a sanctioned encampment that the city has set up, and perhaps start meeting with a caseworker for the first time, maybe get a government ID for the first time in 5 years, you know, sign up for Social Security disability. Like, to him, those are successes that often aren't registered in the number of people who make it into housing.
Yeah, to start to reconnect, maybe, in a way. So, I mean, this podcast series has just kind of started. You're dropping the second episode this week. Where does it go from here? You know, you talked about this mitigation site. I think you're going to keep coming back to that and whether it's been successful. But what else are you going into, and what can people expect to hear if they listen in the coming months.
Yeah, we're trying to tell a story about real people, about characters, about what happens to them over time. But we're also trying to focus on kind of issues that illuminate homelessness at the same time and help people understand it. So in the second episode, we look into this mystery of like, what happened in Olympia? Why did the number of tents downtown go from 30 to 300 in a matter of weeks? That's bizarre. It's a strange occurrence. And we try to figure out, and I think we kind of do, figure out what happened. And it's a really interesting story. And then in the third episode, you know, we've spent all this time in the series at this point talking about homelessness happening to a place and what homelessness looks like when it's happening to a place. And the third episode is where we say, let's look at what homelessness, let's see what homelessness looks like when it's happening in someone's life, right? What happens in someone's life that brought them to one of those tents in downtown Olympia? And I kind of thought that would be a relatively simple question. Like, I thought we'd be able to figure that out. And we quickly realized how incredibly complicated it was to pinpoint the reason that somebody became homeless. And so that's a really interesting episode.
Yeah, I think we'll look forward to hearing more. And, you know, I don't think it's an accident maybe that as this problem grew within sight distance of the state capitol for the first time, really, it's become an issue that the governor has strongly weighed in on. I'm not saying that there's been no weighing in, but he right. put out a pretty big budget proposal trying to tap into the emergency fund, I think, to address some of these issues.
And part of the reason for that was small and mayors and city council members from small and mid-sized cities going to the governor and his staff and saying, we appreciate what the state is doing in terms of incentivizing and funding the construction of housing. We need an emergency response from the state because this issue is overwhelming us. And it was, you know, city officials from places like Olympia, you know, kind of getting the governor's ear, I think that partially led to that response.
And that money, if I recall, would be for kind of emergency level
right.
shelter. And I think there was also a request maybe for a matching fund for cities to even deal with some of the cleanup issues with, you know, just trash. So issues that clearly cities large and small, I think, have raised with the state.
Traditionally, the dichotomy has been that the state kind of deals with the long-term like solutions to homelessness, the construction of housing, things like that. And it's kind of fallen on cities and counties, mostly cities, to kind of deal with the day-to-day emergency response to homelessness. And the governor's proposal is actually kind of a big shift in that dynamic if it were to come to pass.
Although I just want to say that the chance that that's going to pass in the form that Governor Inslee proposed it is, I think, very small at this point.
Right. Legislators have been skeptical about, I think, using the emergency reserve and also the size of it and whether it's, you know, they have questions about whether it will, you know, produce enough results to be worth it. So we'll keep following that too. So I mentioned earlier that you kind of had this hopeful premise to this story, trying some tension as you described, and it's been complicated and it's a difficult situation. So, you know, give us a hint of where this podcast goes. Do you retain this hope? Does it become hopeless? Is it somewhere in between? What can people expect?
You know, one of the problems with reporting something over the course of a year is that when you start, you have no idea where it will go. And that's a little bit scary as a storyteller because you want to tell a good story. What I'll say is the things that happened to the people we were following over the course of that year often shocked me and surprised me. In many cases, a lot of bad things did happen to some of the people we meet early in the series. And in other cases, they end up better off than they were before. And what has been really interesting is to watch like how those stories unfolded differently for different people and why. I think that is one of the most instructive parts of the podcast. But, you know, it does get kind of grim at times, but by no means is it entirely just a, you know, a tour of misery. Like, there are, you know, little glints of hope to be seen and successes. And, you know, over the course of this series, my idea of what success with homelessness looks like has kind of changed too. And so there's some hope to be found in that.
And you're still reporting, and the end is still not known, right?
Yeah, we have room. I really wanted the series to catch up with present day over the course of the series, because I think that's really interesting. And I think people want to know, after being invested in these characters for all these episodes, like, where are they now? So the last episode will be pretty current, and we'll know what happened to a lot of these people.
Great. And just to remind people, best way to find the podcast?
You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You could search for Outsiders or KNKX Outsiders, if that helps as a search term. You could also, the Seattle Times has built a beautiful website, outsiderspodcast.org, where you can also listen to the episodes.
That's all for episode 121 of The Overcast. Thanks to my guests, Will James from KNKX and Scott Greenstone from the Seattle Times. Thanks again to KNKX and Simone Alisea for having us in the studio to record. Thanks for listening. And if you support the independent, locally owned journalism that makes this podcast possible, please visit seattletimes.com/support and consider a subscription. Please rate and leave a review of the podcast. If you'd like to reach out to us, give us some ideas for future episodes, you can reach me on Twitter at @Jim_Bruner. My usual co-host, Dan Beekman's @DBeekman. Until next week, have a cloudy day.